The Rocky Horror Picture Show is a 1975 musical horror comedy that parodies B-movies and is maybe the best bad movie of all time. Its legendary cult following has kept it in theaters with interactive midnight showings for over 40 years, the longest-running theatrical release in history. It's usually shown with a shadow cast, a cast of actors miming the actions and dialogue on the screen, as well as audience callback lines and actions. The movie itself follows a young, innocent couple as they stumble across an outlandish Transylvanian convention in a castle and are led by Dr. Frankenfurter into a mess of music, sexuality, murder, and the creation of life itself. Quite honestly, the discussion of plot in this episode takes a backseat to discussing the music and culture of Rocky Horror, but there are sporadic spoilers throughout. There are also several mentions of sex, nothing explicit, but keep that in mind if you're listening at work or something. My guest today is Brian Hamilton, a podcaster and video editor who falls into that cult following of Rocky Horror that I mentioned earlier. I hope you enjoy our conversation about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Hey, Brian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Quinn?
I am good. So what are we talking about today?
We're talking about the Rocky Horror Picture Show, not the Rocky Horror Show that preceded it, because I have not seen that, but I have seen the Rocky Horror Picture Show many, many times. I'm most excited to talk to you, Quinn, about the cult status that the film has and all the fan stuff surrounding it, but then also the music and the movie itself and all the other fun stuff there.
Just to pull the curtain back on this for 1 second, I think, so Brian's been on the show before. He talked about Spring Awakening last season. The seasons of this show are very arbitrary.
Hi.
But that's fine.
Yes.
And I think in February you claimed a Rocky Horror Picture Show and we were supposed to record it months ago. It's August, but hey, we're here now.
We're here now and we're actually recording the dang thing. We were gonna go, because we lived in the same city for a little while, we were gonna go see a midnight screening of Rocky Horror together, but that wound up not happening, so we just have to do this this Skype edited podcast all together where we're separate and we haven't seen Rocky Horror together, but we've both had our own wonderful important experiences with Rocky Horror.
To be fair, this is probably going to be higher quality than if we did a very silly in-person recording.
Well, Quinn, I really enjoyed watching the movie with you, and we're recording on one mic together. Isn't that nice?
That's what it would sound like.
Yeah, probably. No, we're professionals. So how about you start this off with talking about how did you first experience the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
I was a freshman in high school at this point when I first saw Rocky Horror Picture Show. This was technically a live version of it. This wasn't a shadow cast. This was a stage production of Rocky Horror. I don't think it was the quote-unquote Rocky Horror show, because it has all the elements of the movie and the things that I know are excluded from the musical and in the movie. But it was very similar in that there was people screaming and yelling things from the audience. It was my first time experiencing anything like it. All my friends convinced me to dress up in a skirt and blouse, the most innocuous cross-dressing you could possibly imagine for a 14-year-old kid that did not know what to do with this whole cultural thing. And my favorite moment of this performance of the show was when we showed up and the show started, and people started yelling at the actors, and I thought, what are you doing? You're so drunk and, rambunctious. That's so weird. And then the actor on stage said, okay, wait, stop. For all the people who have never seen Rocky Horror before, people do that. That's the point. I see so many confused faces in the audience tonight, and I want you to know people are going to be yelling. So yell along, cheer along, do whatever the heck you want. Just have a good time. And that set the stage for one of the defining experiences of my life. But I didn't know it then, because then I was a Repo fan. There's an episode of Unjustly Maligned where I talk about Repo, the genetic opera, which was my first horror rock musical love. But it took me a while to get to Rocky Horror after that. And boy, howdy, did it mean a lot to me at that point.
I feel like there is a direct line that can be drawn between Repo and Rocky Horror.
Oh, absolutely. The people that made Repo are huge fans of Rocky Horror, but there's a ton of, Rocky Horror fans hate Repo, but Repo fans love Rocky Horror. There's a lot of people that think that Repo is a derivative work of Rocky Horror, and I don't quite understand why, because they're very, very different. The only only the overtones are at all similar, and even then, they're not that similar. They're horror rock musicals. One of them is made, you know, 30 years after the other, and they're both very silly and inspire the same kind of fandom. But I think there's a lot of people who are like, you're ripping off Rocky Horror. But no, it's totally different. Either way, yeah, that's how I discovered it for the first time, was being in this place in my life where angst and musicals and horror really spoke to me. And in a way, they still do. But in, you know, back then when I was in high school, it really resonated with the way I was feeling in a way that felt socially acceptable, if that makes sense. I talked about this on Waiting for Godot, too. The things that meant a lot to me in high school were things that externalized the way I was feeling and the way I wanted to, you know, see myself in the world, and put it on stage and put it on a screen and make it something that is accessible and reminded me there are other people feeling the same way I'm feeling.
That's beautiful. High school is an angsty emo time.
I looked at the description you wrote for the Spring Awakening episode, and its topics include angst, 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 Pink Floyd, angst, Glee, and angst.
That's a pretty good description of that episode.
It really is, isn't it? Someone reminded us of it a few months ago. I was like, wow, that is a really angsty episode. I'm hoping this one's going to be more fun and happy, because I feel like at this point in my life, I'm still in my Rocky Horror phase, where when we did the Spring Awakening episode, I was very nostalgic for it. I was very looking back, whereas I'm still in the thick of my Rocky Horror phase.
Yeah, there's some, of course, serious stuff to talk about this show with, but it's like, it is so ridiculous in so many ways, and it is just fun is a huge part of why it is so great. And when I was preparing for this episode, it was weird because it's like, I feel like this show is so much more than the other musicals. Is like, it's about the content of the movie, yes, but it's also like, so it's about the experience. Like, it's hardly even a movie. It's a culture.
Exactly. When I was doing some research on the movie today, I found that I brought a soundboard. I thought a lot about all the things that are in the movie that I really hadn't thought about before. Because when I'm watching this movie, all I'm thinking about is the audience participation, the shadow cast, and the culture surrounding it, and not the content of the movie or its context 40 years ago. It's totally different.
I will say, I first saw this movie, I was definitely in high school, and early high school, I think, and I think I saw it, like, on Halloween or something for the first time, and I watched the movie a couple times over the course of high school, and I thought it was really weird, but I was into it, and then my mom grew up outside of Philadelphia, and she said that her friends and her would go to the midnight showings like every week, and they would dress up and they knew all the lines, and that was a thing that they did because, you know, you're a teenager and what else are you going to do? But I grew up in the middle of nowhere and they do not have Rocky Horror showings. So I have never actually gone to like one of the traditional midnight showings, but I did once, a group at school put it on. So it was effectively the same thing, and they had the movie going, and they had a full cast doing all of the lines and the music. I think if I remember correctly, that they muted the movie, so the movie was going, but they were doing all of the spoken lines and singing everything themselves.
Wow, that's really cool.
It was really fun.
I love that so much. For context, because I realize I don't describe what my things are when I'm talking about them on podcasts. Rocky Horror Picture Show is a movie about a recently engaged couple named Brad and Janet, who are going along the road one night and their tire bursts, and so they need to run and look for a phone, and they find a castle where there's a transvestite convention, and they meet a mad scientist who's all in drag, and they're looking for a phone there, but things go off the rails very, very quickly. I had the exact same experience as you when I was when I saw this for the first time. I was so confused about what was going on and why it was going on, because all I knew about it was that this was the silly gay film where it winds up being very queer and ridiculous by the end, and I didn't understand any of the cultural importance of the movie as it was then, or the context of the fan, you know, the cult following when I first saw it. You know, there's so many facets to this that, like, it's a parody of, you know, like 50s B movies and sci-fi movies and other musicals of the time. Like, I don't think Grease had come out, but it was like that kind of teeny bopper rock musical combined with all of the horror tropes of the of those early B movies that are so much fun to make fun of. But now it's like all these things take a backseat to the audience experience and the fan community that the movie has now.
Oh yeah, a big part of this is like, I think that, I mean, I don't think it would have been possible for this to be true, but it would be so funny if this film was created like in sincerity. I mean, because I mean, this was deliberately sort of this parody slash tribute to horror movies, campy B movies, weird goth rock musical, like all these different genres that existed and were often unintentionally funny or unintentionally strange and bad, were all kind of mushed together and leaned into and made something that was very deliberately strange and a weird B movie. And it was not popular when it first premiered. When it first premiered, everyone was like, wow, this is a really bad movie. We don't like this. And then it started picking up steam.
It started picking up a lot of steam. This is technically the longest theatrical run of a movie ever because it's never been pulled from theaters because everyone wants to go see it every Saturday night. What's fun? So people cite this as a so bad it's good movie. And I kind of agree with that. They set out to do what they wanted to do in a way because they were paying tribute to campy movies and the movie itself is really campy. But I think there's another thin veneer of like, this is not a good movie on top of that. And I think that's what makes it so special is that everyone tried so hard to make this genuine, fun, tongue-in-cheek movie and then genuinely failed a little bit. The music is great, but a lot of the set design and acting and like all the props and set were reused from old Hammer movies, which is so cool and gives it a lot of like fan clout. But it's also like these are leftovers from another movie. You know, the acting is kind of okay. You know, it's the music is where everything shines, and that's why I think the movie has stuck around as long as it has. But yeah, it's interesting that this is something that people cite as a so bad it's good movie when there are so many worse movies.
That's the thing, is like you don't get so bad it's good movies without the energy that this has. Like lots of movies are bad and they're just boring, but this is, you know, a bad movie. I like your point. It's like it's intentionally bad and a little unintentionally bad, but I think that you're absolutely right. Like this movie would not have the success that it had if Time Warp wasn't an incredibly catchy song.
And they were making fun of catchy songs that taught people how to do the dance and did the exact same thing really well.
In the show that I went to see at school, I think it was like opening night and we were there and the audience was it was a small audience, small theater, and we were a little timid about kind of joining and doing stuff. But the person playing Riff Raff was amazing. And when we got to the Time Warp, they started like doing the dance part and all the audience is kind of looking at each other like, do we stand up and dance? And then he just goes, get up and dance.
At the Boston show, they do the same thing where people that are a part of the show will say, get up and dance. And most of the people will get up and dance. I certainly get up and dance. But there's a bunch of people that are like, wait, really? This is what happens in this theater? Okay, I guess that's what we're doing now.
What is it like to go to those midnight screenings in Boston?
Sometimes they are a barren wasteland and it's me and maybe four other people. Sometimes it's packed. It's always packed on or around Halloween. I always go at Halloween, but I go pretty often as well. When I was living in New York and very sad, as we talked about on an episode of, I was about to call it the Aspiring Robot Podcast. That's not it. Solidly mediocre. One of your 17 podcasts. as we talked about then, I lived in New York for a while, and I went to the Rocky Horror Picture Show there most weekends, I think, because it was easily accessible and like surprisingly cheap for a midnight thing on a Saturday. And they were so much fun. There was a dance party beforehand. There was like a whole bunch of cast members that wound up recognizing me by the time I left, and it was such a fun time. And there's nothing more, I have some things to say about this later, but for me personally, there's nothing more freeing than a socially acceptable, fun, silly way to yell in a movie theater and dance and, you know, see people acting their butts off in a theater, in like a movie theater while a movie is playing.
I do want to experience this at some point. Luckily, it's not showing any signs of going out of theaters anytime soon.
Yay!
Now, we're going to come back more to the culture stuff later, but let's actually talk about more stuff in the movie first. We keep, like, this episode is about the movie, in case that wasn't clear, because as you referenced earlier, there is a Rocky Horror Show that was originally a stage musical, and that existed, but frankly, I care very little about it, and I know almost nothing about it. It's really, like, it's all about the movie.
It's very similar. They added some stuff to the movie, but, like, the core is there, where there's, you know, Brad and Janet go to the castle, Dr. Frankenfurter's there, Rocky's there. Like, a whole bunch of stuff is the same, but they were able to go a little bit more silly in the movie because there was an actual budget, and you could film things that weren't, you know, like, had to be done every night on stage. My favorite thing about the transition between stage to screen is that in the last act of the movie, when all the characters are turned to stone statues for a little bit, I love how long and weird and pointless that scene is, because in the stage show, I'm sure that's when all the real actors need to run off, change into their drag outfits for the next scene, and then come back. But I love watching that, being like, oh yeah, if this were a stage play, that's exactly what they would be doing.
Mm-hmm. But here, it just drags out for no reason, because we could just cut, but we don't. But yes, let's dive in a little bit to the actual content of the movie, starting with what I think we could both agree is one of, if not the best part of it, the music.
Wait, this is a musical? What?
What? Actually, sometimes when I think about this movie, I kind of forget it's a musical, not because I don't know the songs in it, because I do, but I just feel like it's so associated with all of the zaniness of it, and I forget that the music, like, it actually is in the movie.
100%. The only reason I remember it's a musical ever is because I listen to the soundtrack at least once or twice a week.
Okay, yeah, so I think you've got that covered. But yes, I referenced Time Warp a little while ago, which is probably the most famous song for this musical, I would say. It's great. It is super fun and catchy, and if you listen to it, it's going to be stuck in your head all day. It's stuck in my head all day, and I haven't even listened to it today, so there's that.
It is such a wonderful song. It's like fun rock and roll 50s style, like teach you how to do the dance in the song kind of thing. It is so much fun to listen to even outside the context of the show, which I think is kind of rare in these kinds of musicals. Like Spring Awakening, like we talked about, was built from the ground up to have songs that are separate from the musical. But in such a specific show as Rocky Horror, I feel like a lot of the songs still stand on their own as excellent songs, which is rare for like a sci-fi movie.
Yeah. A lot of them are really weird, as you would imagine, but some other ones just kind of sound like rock songs or even kind of pop songs. One of my favorite songs in the entire movie is Hot Patootie Bless My Soul.
One was not my favorite for a long time because I thought it's just a boring standard song compared to like Sweet Transvestite or Rose Tint My World, all the fun, silly movie specific ones. But the more I go see the movie, the more I start to fall in love with Hot Patootie, because it's like it's such a great song in its own right that I'm able to kind of separate it out, because the movie literally just takes a break from whatever it was doing to sing this very generic, silly, fun, like rock song done by Meatloaf. And it's like I'm starting to appreciate it a lot more because it is a kick butt song.
I think that the first time I saw it was probably my favorite because it was so fun. And I mean, as much as anything in this movie has a real purpose, but like there is no purpose. It's just to be like, hey, Eddie's here and he's great.
He really is great. I'm sad that he's only in one scene, but that's kind of the joke, right? Is that they were able to get Meatloaf to be a part of this movie and he's just there for one scene.
Can you imagine being the Meatloaf fan who goes to see this movie and you're like, wait, what?
It's like going to see Psycho for Janet Leigh.
See, I haven't seen Psycho.
Oh, Quinn. Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Psycho Show. I'm Brian Hamilton here with my co-host, Quinn Rose. How's it going? And today we're analyzing minutes 15 to 18.
Honestly, the Venn diagram of movies that we both like is pretty much just the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
And Repo, once I show that to you.
Yeah, okay.
You'll actually hate Repo.
We'll see. I also like how many songs in this musical are specifically targeting Janet.
Yeah, yeah. So, the character of Janet, played by Susan Sarandon, is, she's the main female lead of the movie. She is the one that is turned from, sweet, recently engaged version to, by the end of the movie. And I feel like the way that the audience treats her is pretty awful. Like, it is objectively really freaking awful. There's a bunch of critique about Rocky Horror in that context, and in the context of, like, of LGBTQ people being the butt of the joke, because that, may as well address this here, that's kind of the point of this, is that it's a parody of, you know, Frankenstein movies and B movies, but the joke is that they're all gay and wearing corsets, and that's really not cool at all. But I think that that part of its fan base today is about reclamation and being like, okay, this is some of the first LGBTQ representation in popular media, and it like really popularized goth and punk culture in a bunch of really cool ways. But today, even though we can look back and be like, we don't really use the word transvestite anymore. We don't really use like any of these things. The attitude of like brainwashing people to make you sex slaves is kind of screwed up. But I think a lot of the culture and fandom surrounding it today comes down to reclamation of these ridiculous things that are happening in the movie.
Yeah, I did want to, might as well just dive into this whole conversation, because that is a big part of what surrounds this movie now. Is it's because this whole thing, I mean, so it came out in like 1975. Yeah, 1975. And it's an incredibly queer movie, but it's also this joke about being queer but at the same time, like the culture and the fan base that has embraced and surrounded it is also largely queer, and it has, people have reclaimed, mm-hmm, everything that it is and embraced everything that it is with varying levels of acceptance of the more problematic aspects of it. And so it becomes this really weird big mess of like, is it okay to embrace this movie on the same level like 40 years later, when society has progressed so much and it's no longer, at the time, the content and everything, obviously like it is a parody, but like the idea of having like this bold, sex positive, gender ambiguous character. Like there, it's the film is quite unclear on defining Tim Curry's Frankenfurter as, is this a cisgender man who is cross dressing? Is this a transgender woman? Is this a non-binary person? The answer really is that it's an alien, and I don't think has a clearly defined gender.
Yeah, I feel like if this movie was made today, they would, like, half of the cast members, half the characters would be using they pronouns and be non-binary, you know? There's no answer to it, but there was also not really the language for that kind of stuff back in the 70s, especially not for what they were trying to make a mainstream rock musical, but that wasn't a thing back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point, because they did make this movie today. They made it, like, last year. They did a remake of it.
Yep. There's a really great article I found about Rocky Horror criticism, and let me see, link in the show notes. Let me see if I can find that little clip. When that utterly forgettable remake came along and they cast Laverne Cox as Frank, it was heralded as a win for diversity. All I could think was, is this really the best time to cast the second most prominent trans woman in America as the monster who destroys clean-cut American youth's innocence? And in a way, I kind of feel that, because textually, there's all these things about Frankenfurter being this monster that, like, that corrupts people and makes people sex slaves, and it's really bad, ugh, disgusting. But like, in culture now, he's heralded as this incredible queer character and, like, progressive, you know, way of looking at gender. And people don't really analyze that. People, me included, look at the song "Rose Tint My World" and the ending going "Don't Dream It, Be It" as kind of like an anthem for, like, yeah, be whoever you are, have your identity and all of that. But in the movie, the context is, like, is not that at all.
Yeah, and I think that's really what it comes down to, is the context of the culture versus the context just inside the actual film, which is, you know, this character does horrible things, not even counting the murder and the cannibalism. Like, this, like, many things in this movie count at the very least is, like, sexually exploitative towards almost every other character in the movie.
Yeah, exactly. And in the context of Janet specifically, one of the big callbacks, whenever anyone introduces Janet, you yell,
"Slut!"
And it's really bad because in this same article, they count it. You know, she has sex twice in the movie. Everyone else has sex twice in the movie. Frankenfurter has sex three times in the movie. And it's like, why is she the slut? You know, it's of all the things to do in the callback, like, that is Rocky Horror Callbacks 101. You call Brad an a-hole and you call Janet a slut, because there's always, like, gaps, perfect size gaps after they introduce each other in the movie, and it's really funny. But it's like the fact that the culture has come to this is really kind of not cool, and her arc in the movie is my favorite because of her own volition, before she's brainwashed, of her own volition, she has a sexual awakening. And it's, A, one of the best songs in the movie, and B, a really fascinating look at, like, repressed 1970s, you know, sexuality in America.
Yeah, that's almost even outside the whole conversation about putting this film in queer context, is, like, also, why are we yelling slut at the woman? Why? That's...
mm-hmm.
That's just, like, there's no... And it could be argued that it's ironic, or that, like, actually lots of people also reclaim the word slut, but when you're throwing it at a character in the movie because she has a song about enjoying sex, no.
Exactly, exactly. There's so much about this movie that does not age well, but I think what does age well is the way that it introduced queerness to America in a really cool rock and roll goth way, you know?
Yeah, it was accessible on a way that it was almost never accessible at that time. And it let people choose all sorts of different forms of expression, because suddenly, like, you could go to these showings and you could dress in ways that you couldn't feel comfortable dressing in your ordinary life. And it was a space for lots of, and it still is a space for lots of people to explore that.
Exactly. From this same the flip side of that, from the same article, a friend of mine once said that Rocky was LGBTQ cosplay for straight people, and that's definitely the sentiment I understand now. It's less of a boundary breaker and more of a chance to get for the comfortable to dip their toes in the perception of LGBTQ culture. And I agree, in a way. It's like, I've definitely seen, like, frat bros in Boston put on lipstick and come to Rocky Horror and laugh at it, not with it. And it's a little upsetting, but it's also, like, the same way that, like, queer people first understand their own sexuality in that same theater, in the same place where people come to laugh at queer people.
And I think that all of you things are true at once, and these characters are empowering, and they're also terrible, and they are good examples and bad examples, and the context of the film is harmful and helpful, and we just have to take all of that and decide where each individual stands with their relationship with this film. Now, all of that being said, that was sort of the big serious conversation that we had to have about the film, and I think we're going to mostly leave that behind.
For me, I identified with Rocky Horror as a sci-fi fan and a fan of, like, midnight movies and the culture surrounding that, because my first big midnight obsession with audience participation was The Room. And so once I, because I'd seen Rocky Horror a bunch before. Yeah, sure, fine, great. But The Room was like my thing for a very long time and still is, but there's much more infrequent screenings of it here in Boston. Rocky Horror was for me the next step in audience participation and fun cult movies and joining that next fandom. And also as a sci-fi fan, we didn't talk about this in the music segment, but my favorite song, I think, well, okay. My second favorite song, at least, is the opener, Science Fiction Double Feature, which is has almost nothing to do with the movie, except for mentioning Brad and Janet once. But it's entirely like nods and references and love letters to a whole bunch of like 30s, 40s, 50s B-movies. Stood still, but he told us where we stand. And Flash Gordon was there in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the Invisible Man. We got Triffids, we've got King Kong, we've got Dr. X, we've got all these different things mashed up into this one song. Sung by a man through a woman's lips on screen. It's Richard O'Brien who plays Riff Raff singing, but it's Columbia's lips with like a blacked out face and just a zoom in on her lips to make it look like it's just a disembodied set of lips. It's like androgynous right from the get-go, but singing about wonderful sci-fi songs. And that's where like the core of the movie is for me, is like that love of like fun sci-fi stuff. And I think that first song is one of the best ways that it signifies that outside of the tone of the rest of the movie.
And that's become unbelievably iconic. Like, you see those red lips and that's Rocky Horror.
Exactly. I never thought about it in this context, but the poster for the movie that really featured the lips, the tagline is "A Different Set of Jaws." And I saw that and I was like, oh, that's kind of clever. It's like, you know, different movie. It's fun. It's queer. It's whatever. Until I remembered Jaws came out that same year, and they designed that poster as a mirror of like the iconic Jaws, like shark swimming up, and you can see the teeth and the mouth and everything like just barely open. But that different set of Jaws thing is like another focus on a mouth to promote a movie, and it says a different set of Jaws. I never got that. That's brilliant.
I literally never put that together. That is brilliant.
Again, I did a lot of research before this recording.
Is that the only soundbite you have, or do you have more you're going to drop in later?
I've got more. I'm going to surprise you with that appropriate points throughout the podcast.
Oh, boy. I don't actually know that much about that aspect of it, because I really haven't seen the kind of campy movies or even just horror movies in general that this film is kind of making fun of slash honoring. Whereas I know that's more your scene, but I don't really think, like, this movie kind of stands on its own in that entire genre for me.
100%. I haven't seen many of the movies they make references to. My biggest touchstone for that kind of campy movie is Mystery Science Theater, when they go back and make fun of really bad sci-fi movies.
I feel like there could be a real theme synthesis between Rocky Horror and Mystery Science Theater 3000. There probably is a Mystery Science Theater 3000 track somewhere for the movie Rocky Horror Picture Show, now that I think about this out loud.
Let's see. Riff Tracks is the spiritual successor to Mystery Science Theater. It's a bunch of the writers going out and releasing like $5 MP3s that you play along with your own copy of the movie, so they don't need to get the rights like they did for Mystery Science Theater, but you could do a whole bunch of stuff. Let's see if Rocky Horror is a Riff Tracks thing. Oh, yeah, it is. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Riff Tracks. Oh, wait a minute. No. Wait a minute. Oh, my God. So, in a tweet to Kevin Murphy, who was a Mystery Science Theater writer and now runs Riff Tracks, would you guys ever Riff Tracks Rocky Horror Picture Show? I famously despise Rocky Horror, so a hard pass on that. What?
How do you?
It's a rock musical. It's B movies. It's everything you love, Kevin Murphy. Come on.
I was about to say, how does someone famously despise something? But I guess maybe people ask him about it a lot because of the natural crossover.
I guess so. Yeah. But it's like two things of people yelling at movies and having a good time and hopefully, and like mad scientists and mad scientists and ridiculous things like that.
That's so interesting. So I guess that doesn't actually exist. I'm sure tons of versions of it exist, but not like the official Riff Tracks situation.
If you get a one of the DVD copies that I have has a audio commentary track where they got like some of the biggest fans of Rocky Horror into a room to have them record their callbacks while you're watching the movie alone. And I can't think of anything more depressing than sitting alone watching Rocky Horror with a recording of other people doing the things that they do when you're watching it live.
This is just a brief anecdote, tangentially related, but I'll say that. So while we're talking about Riff Tracks as well, so there's this movie called Love Story, which came out in 1970, and I just clicked on the Wikipedia page and discovered it's one of the highest grossing films of all time, and now I'm rattled, but okay. I don't think it's a very good movie, but the whole thing is that it was the last movie that was filmed on Harvard's campus. It takes place at Harvard. It's like Harvard students or whatever. And it's a love story, obviously. And a large portion of the film was actually filmed on Harvard's campus. And I don't remember if something in this specific movie made them mad or like they just decided not to, but like no movie or TV show has been filmed on campus since then. I went to Harvard, for people who don't know, which is why I'm suddenly talking about this. But because this was the last movie that was filmed there, they screen it every year for the incoming freshmen. And you can go, and there's a group on campus that has developed a custom riff track for it. And so you go to the screening, and it's a sort of a combination of riff track and callback lines, because it's basically callback lines that only a dozen people know. And so they sit in the back of the theater, and they all have laser pointers. And so they have all the lines memorized. And as the movie goes, they shout out the lines and use a laser pointer to point out things on the screen.
That is amazing. Oh my God.
Talk
about oral tradition, am I right? These people have seen the movie a trillion times every year and just like memorize all the lines.
Well, yeah. And it's like, I'm not sure if they write new lines year to year or they like it's the same callbacks every year, but yeah. And then they like teach they probably have like printed out copies or whatever, so not everyone has to memorize every single callback, but it's a fun experience.
In the Boston Rocky Horror cast, at least, there's people that are employed by the show or volunteers at the show who have all the callbacks memorized. And like sometimes they come up with really elaborate ones that are like they're fun and great, but they're really like you can tell that they're written out, you know. And some of my favorite things I've ever done in a Rocky Horror theater are completely made up, something that I just like, oh, that'd be funny, and I say it and it gets a huge laugh. Like I love, especially there's moments in the show where like you can write new culturally relevant lines. There's a few moments in the show, like specifically when they bring out when they show an empty room. It was a room that was once full and is now empty in the next shot. And a lot of people are like, ladies and gentlemen, a Nickelback concert. Or, ladies and gentlemen, the inauguration. Like, different culturally relevant jokes about having an empty room go in there perfectly. And it's one of my favorite things about the show is that it changes and morphs as time goes on and, like, hyper-current references can be thrown in.
I actually didn't even realize until I started looking at this quite recently for this podcast, that the lines changed so frequently is because I knew that like people would go and then they would participate and shout all the lines and there was sort of a defined script. And then it was like, well, there is, but then there's also space and lines that change year to year, screening to screening, or even like community to community, depending on what's relevant and what people in those spaces have developed. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense. And that's awesome.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yes.
Okay, just you, me, and everyone that listens to the show. I've seen Rocky Horror in, I think, 4 or 5 different cities over the course of my life. And I have absolutely taken lines from one screening to the next. I'd be like, oh, no one went to that is at this Boston screening right now went to this New Jersey show. Ha ha ha. I get to make them think I came up with this. Ha ha ha. I've definitely done that.
That's like being an internet meme stealer, but in real time.
Repost of a repost. I'm the guy that's screenshotting Instagram things and putting them on Twitter without crediting
the original. Yeah, and cropping out the original creator.
No, I'm a monster.
But just with Rocky Horror Picture Show jokes, and only the people at the screenings will ever hear them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I'm making jokes about this, but, like, that's the kind of joke sharing that I don't think the people that you borrowed the jokes from would be that mad, because it's a matter of sharing that humor and that culture. It's like, it's not like anyone's getting credit for Rocky Horror Picture Show jokes, you know? It only enhances the experience to share them around.
Exactly. It's like a game of Cards Against Humanity where by the end you really don't remember all the good ones from during the thing because of how many funny, silly things just happened. Like, it's really hard to single out one really good one. So that's, I try to learn more callbacks every time I go so I can be more on the ball. I'm very insecure about this because I feel like I am at my funniest and most liked when I'm at a movie that you get to yell at, which is very insecure of me, but it's the reality.
Is that a situation that ever happens not at Rocky Horror?
What do you mean?
You said you're at your funniest when you're being able to yell at a movie. And I'm like, is that only Rocky Horror? Or are you in that situation other times?
Well, no. The Room and Repo are the shadow casts I go to fairly often. Repo I've only seen once, but there's only been one in the Northeast in the time I've lived here. The Room I've seen more than I've seen
and
Rocky
you've
Horror.
Checked.
Yep, I look all the time.
Wait, so when in the Room, do you also yell things at the screen? Is that what happens?
Abso-freaking-lutely. Quinn, when are you in Boston next? We're going.
Listen, you were supposed to take me to a screening forever ago, and then you didn't.
Okay, that is my fault, but that would not, absolutely not have been a yelling, screaming, like, screening of the Room, because it was in conjunction with a Disaster Artist actually put out by A24. There's no way people would have done the callbacks at that very prim and proper screening.
I like that you specifically remember which screening you almost took me to, by the way. I appreciate that.
Yes!
But then, wait, so, and the, but there, what are the, how often does the Room show? Now we're off topic, but I know nothing about this, really.
At least once a month at the Coolidge in Boston. Most major cities have at least a monthly Room screening. It's not weekly, like most Rocky is, but it's like, a lot of the callbacks in the Room are similar to Rocky in that you kind of, it's like ridiculous timing, making fun of things that are on the screen, and then completely separate things that have morphed out of the movie. The most famous Room one is there's a framed picture of a spoon in the movie because they didn't, when they got these picture frames for this like $20 set, they didn't take out the default like printer paper BS that's in all the picture frames you see in like Targets and things, but there's just a picture of a spoon. So people have started bringing plastic spoons to screenings of the Room, and whenever that's on the screen, they will throw plastic spoons. It will rain plastic spoons. Those are the kinds of fun, ridiculous things that have morphed out of these different screenings and different like cultures and fan cultures that surround these movies, is stuff that like you're so bored during this movie because it's a terrible freaking movie, but you make it fun by laughing at the movie and by just entertaining yourself by bringing footballs or wearing a newspaper for a hat like you do in Rocky Horror, or any number of other things that make the screening more fun that are only tangentially related to the movie. But you like, there's a huge thrill in doing ridiculous things in a movie theater where you're typically like, shh, turn off your phone, this is a movie. But in these contexts, you get to live your life and go wild. I've written papers about this in college.
Well, you were a film student.
That's true.
Clearly, I just learned about this, but I feel 100% confident that like those kinds of screenings and experience with the Room wouldn't exist without the existing culture with Rocky Horror. Like Rocky Horror is the pioneer of all of that. And I'm sure that without that experience that people wouldn't be doing the same kind of thing for other movies as well.
Exactly. Can I tell you about some of my favorite Rocky callbacks?
Yes, you can.
Yay. Thank you. So there's a whole bunch of really fun ones in the movie that, a lot of the callbacks are responses to things in the movie, like lyrics of songs that if you do the timing just right, you're almost singing along with lyrics that aren't there. I have an example for you.
Okay.
from the day he was born.
Not the night, but the day.
He was trouble.
Not monopoly, but trouble.
He was the thorn.
Not the rose, but the thorn.
In his mother's side.
Not the front, but the side.
She tried in vain.
Not the artery, but the vein. And you have to do it in Dr. Scott's ridiculous voice, where he's like, ah, yes, I am the German Dr. Scott. I am here as a part of the government. Like, you make fun of his accent at the same time that you're making fun of the lyrics of the song. Those lyrics, those callbacks are pretty standardized at this point, because it's like, what kind of silly jokes can you make in between lines of the song? So it's gotten to the point where, at this point in the movie, it's a dinner table scene where... Filmically, it's not that interesting. It's just a bunch of characters sitting around a table having a discussion, but then they break into song. So the shadow casts of Rocky Horror at this point in the show, they get goofy. They get ridiculous because it's all of them just sitting there mouthing along with the lines. So during these particular very solidified callbacks, they will pantomime, like, not zeros but the phone, not monopoly but trouble. Like, they will pantomime along with that because it is so ingrained in the culture. It's a boring freaking scene, and it's like, what else are you gonna do? It is one of my favorite, and it's especially because it's so prolonged, and it's like an entire verse of the song is perfectly written for dumb jokes to be made about this guy's accent.
There is so much space in this movie given between lines that I don't know if it's like, if we could really sit down and do this with any movie, we just don't realize how much space there is, or if it's just a perfect aspect of what this is that allows us to do that.
When Rocky Horror was first described to me, that was the point. It was that there are so many gaps in the movie to be filled by the audience.
You could cut down this movie by 30 minutes, but they left all that space in just so we could yell at it. How nice.
Exactly. The other brand of callback that is really fun is when the movie's going on and someone like asks the movie a question. And the movie kind of responds. Like, you've seen the movie a trillion times, you can get the timing right, and you ask the movie something, and the movie responds. For example, what's the opposite of hoo-ha? It's like, it's such a dumb joke, but you fill the time with, like, what's the opposite of this? Oh, and my favorite one that I swear I came up with this one. This is a Brian Hamilton original callback.
Mm-hmm.
What does the fox say? That one always gets a big laugh, and it really makes me happy that that is my joke that I came up with. I did not steal that from anybody.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Quinn, this is one of my favorite movies of all time, not because I like the movie, but because I love the culture surrounding it. And like, people have compared this to religious experiences, and going to church every Sunday, going to Rocky Horror every Saturday night is like church to me.
I feel like that is incredibly sacrilegious to a certain kind of religious person.
Well, have they seen Rocky Horror? There's a lot of sacrilege in there.
That's what we are here for. I think that's beautiful, and I look forward to one day going to your campy rock and roll church.
Campy rock and roll church. Ding, title.
Now, are you ready for the lightning round?
Yes, I'm ready for the lightning round. You can hear the thunder and the lightning in the distance as the rain falls down on Janet's newspaper.
Okay. What's your favorite song?
Rose Tint My World. The floor show is my favorite part of Rocky Horror, because even though, as we talked about, it's kind of screwed up in sexual servitude and all that, it is the epitome of the sexual freedom of Rocky Horror and the fun, ridiculous stuff that, like, at this point in a B-movie, this would be, like, the climactic scene, like, battle between all the characters, like, going up against the evil doctor or whatever. In this one, it is a drag show for nobody by the main characters.
Rose Tint My World keeps me safe from my trouble and pain.
And the music is so good. It's like a suite in three parts where everyone has a bunch of verses and things. And the set design for this whole set is like the most over-the-top part of the entire movie. Roast in My World is my favorite song.
And what's your favorite line in the movie?
In the movie or said by the audience?
Do you want to do one of each?
Yes, absolutely. My favorite line in the movie is... this is a hard one. Because all my favorite lines in the movie relate back to audience callbacks. I'll just do the audience callback. The narrator of the movie is a criminologist played by Charles Gray, and he gets the brunt of the meanest callbacks in the show because he's wearing this tux and you can't see his neck, so everyone's making fun of him. Where is your neck? And his introduction in the movie is him taking a book off the shelf to explain and tell the story. And my favorite callback for that is when he opens up the book and people go, "Let me show you my Pokemon cards. I have a Charmander and a Squirtle and a Mewtwo," as he's like flipping through the pages and starting to narrate the movies. That is my favorite dumb joke in the audience callbacks.
Incredible. Who's your favorite character?
Columbia. She was, I think, my first major crush on a movie star. So Columbia is by far my favorite character. And she has some of the best moments in songs, even though she doesn't have her own song. My favorite singing moment of hers is her verse in Rose Tint My World. She has a really great verse in Time Warp and I'm Going Home. There's a close-up of her singing, but she has the best moment of Rose Tint My World, I think.
The fact that that was your first big crush says everything about you.
Yep, literally everything. I got to talk to her at Comic-Con last year. There was a Boston Fan Expo panel with Barry Bostwick, Columbia Magenta, whose actor names I don't remember. But it was incredible. I asked them a question. I forget what it was, but I was like, "Hi, you're my favorite. You're my first crush ever from like 40 years ago." Wow. I didn't actually say that, but that's a thing that happened.
That's awesome. If you could play a character, who would you want to play?
My favorite thing about this question is that that's a possibility. There's a shadow cast. I think I would make a really good Rocky because I just stand there and do nothing for most of the show. Nice. Gosh, who would I actually play? I don't know. I feel like I could do a pretty good Brad because he has a lot of like ridiculous macho man moments. Like, he is the quasi sci-fi hero of the movie, even though he has almost no role like that in the movie. He has no agency. He's just like the character you would expect to be the hero, but he's kind of shoved off to the side. I think I'd be a pretty good Brad.
This question is, who would you recommend go see this? Which I would say, who would you recommend goes to a midnight showing of it?
I'm trying to not answer everybody, because I tend to be the person that's like, "This is my favorite movie. You would totally love it." But nobody likes Green Room if they're not into like extreme cinema already. I would say anybody who is like between the ages of 15 and 20, age permitting, of course, if you can't be let into the theater, whatever. If you are at that stage in your life, I feel like Rocky Horror gives you a lot of context, not only for yourself, but also culture at large. And also gives you a cool way to express yourself if this aligns with you. So people go see Rocky Horror and they're like, "Oh, that was fun. I'm glad I've seen it once." And then there are people like me who are like, "I have to see this every week for the rest of my freaking life." And I feel like the only way to find out if this is for you is to go. So I would recommend anybody who is at that stage in their life when they are more open to interesting new things, go see it, because it's going to give you a lot of context for a lot of different subsets of culture.
And if you could combine this musical with another one, which would you pick and why is it Repo the Genetic Opera?
Thank you for answering for me. The two of them have very similar sensibilities and they are so much fun in the same way that like they're movies to entertain you and kind of slot into this very narrow niche that there aren't many movies for. So the movies that are really good and part of that genre, people really latch onto and love. So I've seen Repo like 50 times. I've seen Rocky Horror like 50 times. And to mash them up, I imagine it would be like Rocky Horror set in the future, much more gory and with much better, like a much better overall cast, I think, because Repo has a stronger cast. It's got like Anthony Stewart Head and Sarah Brightman and a bunch of Alexa Vega, a whole bunch of like really great singers. And I imagine that giving them the Rocky Horror music along with the more industrial aspects of Repo would make a fascinating movie. How would you know Repo would be my movie?
I've met you.
You're not wrong.
All right. And those are all my questions. This means we have come to the end of this episode of Corner of the Sky. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about this.
Lost in time, lost in space, and meaning. I'm so glad I was here. This was so much fun.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you like, you could also review us in Apple Podcasts or recommend us in Overcast. Until next time, I don't know, maybe don't go into the scary castle on the side of the road. Brian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Quinn?
I am good. So what are we talking about today?
We're here tonight to talk about one of my very favorite musicals and favorite musical things about the internet. It's Elliot Kalin's Letter Songs from the Flophouse. Now, every episode when they introduce the letter segment, Elliot Kalin sings a song all about letters, and he sprinkles in a whole bunch of other like Broadway influences and references and a whole ton of really wonderful things. And, sorry, there's lag. I can't hear you. And I'm loving the fact that every episode he'll do a whole bunch of really great like references to other things, and he'll go on way too long with the joke is my favorite part about it, because he'll start singing and then he'll go on and on and on and on and on, and it doesn't stop. And the other co-hosts are like, "Ugh, Elliot, can you please stop singing letter songs?" And he doesn't. And it's one of the funniest things. One of the funniest episodes of the Flophouse ever was when he kept singing way, 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 way too long past when the joke was funny. And then inexplicably, Stuart Wellington chimes in with more singing and keeps going for another like 2 minutes. And the song doesn't stop because they keep singing in between all the letters. And there'll be a link in the show notes to that moment. It's from the Aloha episode, and it's the song That's How It Works, which is very, very famous. What's your experience with the Flophouse been, Quinn?
A, you know I have no idea what you're talking about. B, I'm going to hang up this Skype call and go away. 'Cause I think that's beautiful. I cannot wait to go to the I got halfway through that sentence and I just
movie
gave up.
Picture.
I need to start over. I was going somewhere with that and then I just gave up. Okay.